She is shipping up to Boston. Tara Sullivan is the Globe's new sports columnist. She comes to us by the way of New Jersey and New York. Tara has some great stories about her time there. Then, Saturday is the Breeders' Cup, when some of the best thoroughbred racehorses in the world all compete on one day. We have the voice of Suffolk Downs, T.D. Thornton, to tell us all about it. Welcome to Season Ticket, a daily podcast from the Boston Globe Sports Department and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tara Sullivan has been writing about sports in the New Jersey, New York area since 1994. She's an award-winning, well-respected columnist for the North Jersey Record, which most people still refer to as the Bergen Record. As sports editor of the Globe, I feel I've added a big free agent to an already potent columnist lineup with Dan Shaughnessy and Chris Gasper, who is, of course, the usual host of Season Ticket. Tara joins us now, and she's going to give us some great stories. Welcome to the Globe, Tara.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Tara, I'd like to establish your mission statement. What can you promise readers of the Globe and Globe.com when you come here starting December 3rd?
Well, I think if I boiled it down to one word, even though I rarely write one word, it would probably be a relationship. What I've built my career on as a sports columnist in particular is connecting with the readers. So, you know, I'll be out there hopefully to be a voice for the readers to connect with their voice.
Well, that sounds wonderful, and we're certainly looking forward to it. Now, besides your great writing in the columns, Tara, two things I associate with you, two really interesting national media incidents. First, your really unusual experience at the Masters. Tell our listeners what happened at the Masters that one year.
Yes, that was, we go back to 2011, and if golf fans remember, it was the year Rory McIlroy was poised to win the Masters. He had a commanding lead going into Sunday, and then, you know, complete and spectacular and awful flameout on the Sunday. So through the end, after they signed the scoring card, as the media group, you tend to just keep following the golfer. Sometimes they'll stop and do media. So we ended up heading toward the clubhouse and go down a hallway, and there's a small locker room there that the players can use. It's not their main one, but they can change their shoes. They collect mail. They do things. And it's open to the media. So I happened to be at the back end of the group. I was probably the last one trailing. And as the group went through the front door that was heading toward the locker room, I got stopped. I was the last one to try to go through. And the security guard who was there said to me, "You can't go in. Women are not allowed." So I was stuck. It was just such a, even still when I say it out loud, it seems so crazy. And I tried to plead my case. "Listen, of course I'm allowed. Here's my credential. We all go in." You know, I'm trying to explain to the woman, like, this has been legislated in federal court. Like, I promise you, you know, And there were colleagues ahead of me who, you know, they tried to speak up for me. But at the same time, I didn't want to get in the way of other people doing their jobs. I have too much respect for other people, you know, to really create this massive scene or anything. So I guess in the long run, that is one of the things I take from it, that my colleagues were incredibly supportive. And even if I think you flash back maybe 10 or 15 years, there might not have been as much, you know, immediate understanding and outrage on my behalf. And then what happened was I went back into the media room. So now where I have access to my laptop and my cell phone and to Twitter, and I tweeted about it. And, you know, that was my firsthand experience understanding what it means to go viral. You know, it became a national story, and it deserved to be so, because what they did was just idiotic. It lasted for a while. It was a little crazy.
I like how you fought for your right there, and that's what Globe readers can expect from you.
Absolutely. Had to.
So does Derek Jeter still have your, is he still taking your calls?
Oh, boy, the other one, talk about viral, right? So Derek Jeter. Now, Derek Jeter, for me, I happened to cover the entirety of his career. I was just starting around 96 when he came up, 95, 96. So now I'm there at the end for when Jeter's going to retire, and the season wasn't actually over yet, but he had a kind of a full retirement press conference. And oh, when I think about the perfect storm of things, I remember we interviewed Girardi in the morning and I used my digital recorder and it wasn't working. The volume, I couldn't get a volume on it. So I switched to my cell phone when we came to speak to Jeter. So I go into the interview room and it's packed. Normally it's not that crowded. So I said, well, I'll put my recorder on the table, which are all things I very rarely do. So now I'm using the cell phone. I'm putting it on the table. I had never really used my iPhone as the voice recorder before. So even though I put it on vibrate, I did not put it in airplane mode. So Jeter is up there answering questions. He says,
"Someone's phone's ringing."
and it was my phone.
Walt Reinheimer. Are we good? Hey, Walt, you have to call you back, buddy.
So from that point, it took off. You know, it was on the Not Top 10 on ESPN, and Inside Edition called and wanted to do a sit-down with myself and my husband. And, Jeter holding this pink, sparkly phone, you know, the phone case my daughter had given me for Christmas that was covered in rhinestones. I mean, it was so funny. But I have to give Jeter credit. I mean, he handled it so well. I mean, it's mortifying from the reporter perspective. I think it was weirder for my husband, who is not in this business and got a taste of what it was like, you know, to be in the middle of a little bit of a media storm.
So let's make this clear to everyone. Tara is from New Jersey, but she's no fan of the Yankees or Jets. She just knows a lot about those teams. So let's start with the Yankees. Can you assess their season this year?
Well, from the perspective down here, this was almost a year ahead of schedule, I think, to have advanced as far as they did in the playoffs. I'm not sure that they saw that this year. And to see an emergence of kind of exciting and interesting young stars, guys like Aaron Judge and Gary Sanchez and Greg Bird. So, you know, when you assess this year, kind of a no-brainer, big success. But really interesting to me because also like a stepping stone, right? I mean, what are the expectations in Boston for the Red Sox? They're built around winning the World Series, right? Not just making the playoffs.
Absolutely.
So here, right? I mean, it's a certain standard of expectation with, you know, based on a history of success. I mean, when was the last time both teams are hiring new managers despite making the playoffs? So for the Yankees,
I think that speaks to what the demands are for those jobs.
Absolutely.
And for those teams and the expectations of those teams.
And the expectations. And so from the perspective right now, it looks like it should be a great AL East race next year.
So the Jets, let's turn to football. The Jets organization, is it as bad as it looks from up here?
I mean, how bad does it look? You know, I know what it looks like down here. What is the perception out there?
Well, they won last night, so we'll give them credit for that.
Right.
But they always look like a disaster. They get optimistic, and then people say they're going to tank for the overall number one pick.
We just seem
like there's no direction down there.
And that's the short answer is yes, because no direction is one thing, which you point to exactly, but no identity, I think, is the bigger thing that I've seen. The New York market, right, is a little different in that there are two pro teams, right, in every pro sport. Mm-hmm. So you kind of always have this comparison game. And the Jets get frustrated by that because there is a comparison. But when you cover the Giants and you're around them, you know what an organizational identity is, just as you do, at least from down here, the perspective of the Patriots, you know what that identity is. The Jets, my goodness, it changes like they change their winter coat. I mean, it's constant. Like, they tried a Patriots approach, right, when they hired Eric Mangini years back, and everything was buttoned down, and everything was serious, and we don't say anything, and, you know, didn't really work, ended up firing him. Then they go to Rex Ryan, and with the same GM, might I add, it was as if there was a personality change. Everything was ha-ha, laugh, we'll say anything, Super Bowls, we'll put it all on the table, you know. So now that's the identity they took it on of the coach, and then of course, they realized, you know, that the children were in charge, and they shifted back and they hired Todd Bowles, who might be a little bit more of a hybrid. But the point being, who is setting the tone with the Jets? So the short answer is yes, it's a mess. Now, I do have to give them credit. What they have going right now is surprising. Really good rookie draft picks. And, you know, they found this veteran quarterback who's held things together pretty well. But around the Jets, trust me when I tell you, you never have faith in it. It's very hard to believe that that's going to sustain itself, you know, for the run of a couple seasons, because it just hasn't happened.
All right, one last thing we want to talk. Well, let's have some Jersey talk. I'm from New Jersey.
All
you're
right.
From New Jersey.
Yes.
We both love Bruce Springsteen. You even have that on your Twitter account. You say you love Bruce Springsteen. How many times have you seen Springsteen? Do you know the number?
Sure. I can tell you it's triple digits.
Triple
so
digits.
I don't know it exactly. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
That's incredible. So, all right, can I ask you a Springsteen trivia question?
I'll give it a shot.
And you're a Jersey girl, so here's why you should know this. Now, the song Jersey Girl, Bruce sings it often, especially if he's playing in the New York, New Jersey area.
Correct.
He did not write that song. Do you know who wrote that song?
Tom Waits.
Very good. Outstanding. See, readers of the Globe, this is the type of information and expertise you're going to get from your new columnist, Tara Sullivan. Tara,
Bruce, did write the final verse. I just have to add that. The one that is most depressing and dark, Bruce did write. He put his own spin on that tremendous song, which I heard three nights in a row not long ago, MetLife, and it was fantastic.
Tara, we can't have enough Sullivans at the Globe, so welcome to the Globe, and thanks for joining us on Season Ticket, the first of many appearances.
Thank you very much. Really looking forward to it.
Up next, we're off to the races. talking about an often overlooked but very exciting series of horse races this weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back, and I have a favor to ask. If you like Season Ticket, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribing is the best way to make sure you get the latest episode as soon as it's available. Moving right along, Saturday is the Breeders' Cup. It's being held at Del Mar in San Diego. It's a series of thoroughbred horse races, and there's $28 million at stake for the winners of the 12 races. When it comes to horses, if you only pay attention to the Triple Crown, you're missing out. T.D. Thornton is an author, longtime freelance writer for the Globe, horse racing expert, and the track announcer at Suffolk Downs. Here he is in action.
Rio Grey at 2-1 is opening up on the field. Adirondack Express is all out in second. Rio Grey has more left for the drive, and Rio Grey is the winner. Adirondack Express.
T.D., welcome to Season Ticket.
Joe, thanks for having me. Usually it's quite a switch because usually you're up in my sound booth at Suffolk Downs. This one's a little more technologically advanced here at the Globe, but I think you have to agree, I have the better view.
You do, and it's great fun when TD lets me come up watching the races from up there and hearing them call them is really a great experience. But besides that, TD, you are a great writer, and your most recent book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. But my favorite is the first book you wrote, Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track. Tell us how you came to write those books.
Well, Not by a Long Shot was based on a journal that I kept during my years working at Suffolk Downs, and specifically the year 2000 racing season. Hard to believe it's been 17 years since that's gone by, but a lot of the issues are still with us today. And the premise that I had for writing Not by a Long Shot was I had read all this great literature when I was a young, budding racing reporter and a racing fan. And it was always about the pinnacle of the profession, horses who won the Kentucky Derby and horses who compete in races like this weekend's Breeders' Cup. But it didn't resonate with what I knew on a daily basis at Suffolk Downs, which is more of a mid-level, maybe almost a minor league racetrack experience at that time in the year 2000. And I wanted to give a voice to the characters that I thought made the game go, the people behind the scenes who are really a heck of a lot more fascinating than some of the horses and the trainers and the jockeys and the headlines. This is where they start. And this is where a lot of good, young, talented horses and jockeys come up through the system. And it's where the best stories are, too.
Yeah, I found it informative, fun, and sad, all rolled into one. It really struck a lot of chords with me. It's a wonderful book. It won an award, and I would highly recommend it to everyone. So turning to the Breeders' Cup, horse racing in general, TD, gambling is such a huge part of it. In his book about Suffolk Downs, there's lots of talk about gambling. But there are some people who want to get associated with racing who want to pretend that gambling's not a big part of it, but that's what it's all about, isn't it, really? Without gambling, there's no horse race.
You can divide that gambling into different facets, too, because everything about horse racing is in and itself a gamble. There's the gamble of the, you know, let's face it, the danger of horse racing is part of the allure. Seeing these horses, these magnificent athletes, they weigh about 1,000 pounds. They can go from a dead stop to 35 miles an hour fairly quickly. It's a dangerous profession for the jockeys. The finishes are often close. They race in tight packs and tight formations. So in one sense, the jockeys are always gambling, literally with their lives for some of them. And for people who invest in the horse racing game, that's a gamble too, because you could buy a horse as a yearling, a young colt, valued at millions and millions of dollars. It's no guarantee that it's going to get you into races like the Breeders' Cup or the Kentucky Derby. Yet you can also parlay that gamble the other way. We've seen horses that are that were really rather modestly bred or went for very low purchase prices at public auctions, and they've gone on to be champions. So that's the allure of the gamble there. And then, of course, the gambling that you're speaking of is the money that flows through the betting windows, $10 billion every year here in North America. And it's really, especially what I noticed during my decades at Suffolk Downs, is it can be the great equalizer. Just because you're a brilliant person in another aspect of your career doesn't mean you're going to win picking the ponies. And it's a great leveler, because the guy who's down at the grandstand betting his last $2 looking to scrape up some tickets off the floor if that's his last loser is not too far from the guy who is up in the turf club eating shrimp cocktail, betting tens of thousands of dollars a whack on individual races. There are guys who are anonymous and do their studying very quietly and are very successful. And it's usually I've found out in horse racing, the guys that brag the most about winning or talk the most about it usually aren't the most profitable. It's the guy, much like in the investing world, the guys who are quiet and keep their mouth shut and find an angle, those are the ones who are going to make some money gambling.
I find that to be true also. So the Breeders' Cup at Del Mar tomorrow, where the turf meets the surf. Should I sing the song, the Bing Crosby song?
Please spare us that. But
there is actually a song that is the official song of Del Mar Racetrack where they're having the Breeders' Cup tomorrow. But the racing is the antithesis of what happens at Suffolk Downs. This is the elite, and it's just an incredible betting opportunity for people like you and me, right, TD?
And there are horses. These are dubbed as Thoroughbred Racing's World Championships. They only occur once a year. So if you contrast that, for example, to the Kentucky Derby, you can only run in the Kentucky Derby once when you're a three-year-old. These races are for horses of different ages. They're different specialists. Some of them run long races. Some of them run very short sprints. Some run on the grass. Some run on the dirt. And they come from all over. They come from Europe, sometimes Australia, the Far East. So it is truly a world championship event. And the difference, tying it back to the gambling aspect, is you can bet on a 70-1 long shot in an everyday run-of-the-mill claiming race at Suffolk Downs. And you're probably not going to get much bang for your buck there, but a horse who's 70-1 in a Breeders' Cup championship race has already had a resume, so to speak, has already has the credentials to prove that it belongs on the world stage. So those horses are often a big price in the betting because they're overlooked by the bettors, not because they don't have the chance. And you see some tremendous upsets in the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, for me, it's put the do not disturb sign out, and I'm focused on the Breeders' Cup. It starts a little mid-afternoon. 3 o'clock up to about 8 o'clock, and I'm just going to be zoned in and hopefully cashing some big dollars. The big race of the day comes at the end, the Breeders' Cup Classic, worth $6 million. What's your recommendation to the people? And people can, if you want to go over to Suffolk Downs, people, you can bet on the Breeders' Cup at Suffolk Downs if you wanted to. But TD, what's your thoughts on the Classic?
The Classic is like the heavyweight championship, to put it in human athletics terms. And this year, it comes down, even though there's a field of 11 in this year's Breeders' Cup Classic, it's a heavyweight title fight that comes down to two horses. You have Arrogate, the horse who was phenomenal last year. He's trained by Bob Baffert, the gentleman who trained American Pharoah, our first Triple Crown winner in 37 years. And Arrogate might even be a faster, better horse than the retired American Pharoah. He burst onto the scene last year. He won the most important race at Saratoga. He then won the Breeders' Cup Classic last year and won two important races, one of them the world's richest horse race, another one over in the Middle East in Dubai. They gave Arrogate a freshening, some time away from the races, and when he came back this summer, he wasn't the same horse,
no,
Joe.
At all.
And unfortunately for him, he ran two clunker races. Well, I shouldn't say clunkers.
They're clunkers. Don't be kind. They're clunkers.
They were clunkers. They were fourth and second place finishes, but he should have annihilated those fields.
Yes, exactly.
And those races, unfortunately for Arrogate, came at Del Mar, where the Breeders' Cup will be run on Saturday. So now here's a horse who was the top dog last year. He got knocked off his perch a little bit, and he's going to have to claw his way back to dominance. In the meantime, the horse who he beat twice late last year and early this year, Gunrunner, has risen in prominence. I mean, his stock has soared. He is now the top horse in North America, while Arrogate has lost a notch or two. So we're going to have to see. Do you bet the horse who has the back class, the proven credentials, or do you bet the up-and-comer? And this will be kind of, either way, it's going to be the swan song for Arrogate because his connections have stated he will be retired and go off to stand as a stud after this race. Gunrunner has a lot left to do. I think I would have to give the advantage to the horse who's in current good form, and that's Gunrunner.
So I'll just say this, TD. I don't like either of them. I don't know if Gunrunner can get the mile and quarter distance well enough to win the race, and I think Arrogate's done. I'm a collected guy, which I'll officially pick in the paper tomorrow, and it'll be online at globe.com soon. Collect It, who beat Arrogate in his last race. That's my selection.
I think Collect It, however, won almost by attrition. He didn't beat Arrogate. He won because Arrogate didn't show up. And if you would like, I will book your bets.
This is the type of competition I love when it comes to gambling. I love that attitude. So, TD, let's go. You as an announcer at Suffolk Downs. Suffolk Downs has a great history of announcers. Larry Colmus, who will be calling the Breeders' Cup on Saturday for NBC Sports, was your predecessor at Suffolk Downs. And so in your years at Suffolk Downs, do you have a favorite call that you've made, a race you remember?
I don't necessarily have a favorite call, but one thing that I want to relate, and to people who aren't familiar with horse racing, it's a series of remembering and forgetting nine times a day. So my short-term memory is working at the expense probably of the erosion of my long-term memory. And when you go into call the races on a daily basis, I like to, and I'm going to tie it into, you mentioned the predecessors, Big Jim Hannon, the gentleman who called the races for several decades.
Tremendous announcer and a great guy.
60s, 70s, and when he turned 80 years old, even though he had been long retired, he came up to the Suffolk Downs announcer's booth, and we had a day in his honor. And I will always remember one thing as a horse race announcer myself that Big Jim said to me that day, which was, you know, he said it in a much more gravelly, deep voice, because Jim talks several registers lower than I do.
He really does, yes.
And he said, I did this for 40 years, and I came to my job every day for 40 years, and I never once considered it work. And that's what it's like being a racetrack announcer. You're right there. You're in and amongst the action, but you're not the show. You have to let these magnificent horses, these very talented athletes, the jockeys who guide them around the racetrack in a very dangerous profession, you're just explaining the show. And the great thing about horse racing is it can be the most difficult play-by-play live sports announcing job, because your event is over in the span of about a minute, maybe 2 minutes if it's a longer race. You don't know what's going to happen. You're calling the action live. Once the words come out of your mouth, and I've made plenty of mistakes, you can't take them back. But that's part of being up on the ledge, so to speak, and the allure of it for me as an announcer. And you never know what's going to happen. The most nondescript, quote-unquote, ordinary race at Suffolk Downs can produce a bizarre finish, a bizarre happenstance, a historical moment, a track record. And that was the beauty of it for me. I just walked up to the roof of the Suffolk Downs every day for years. I looked out onto this great green expanse out there, and I got to see what to me is the most magnificent sporting show in Boston repeated and played out. And I got to be a little bit of a part of that. And that's what I loved about my time at Suffolk Downs.
What great passion to hear from you. And I share your passion for horse racing. And not as many people do now as they used to. But you and I will enjoy tomorrow greatly. And remember, folks, Gunrunner from T.D. Thornton. T.D., thank you so much for joining us at Season Ticket.
Good luck, Joe, tomorrow. Hit 'em hard.
Thanks for listening to Season Ticket. We'd like to thank our producers who are racing to finish this. TD, take it away.
Stand by for the credits. And they're off in the Season Ticket Stakes. And Steve Safran had a sharp start, followed in close attendance by Scott Thurston. And Josh Swartz is away straight away from the gate. And these three peel off from the pack in the early stages. Jessica Alpert, mid-pack and biding her time right now, and John Parati is outside of runners, and Matthew Reed starts to kick it in, and Joe Silky Sullivan, last of all at this point in the race. Josh Schwartz, Steve Safran continue to fight it out on the front end through swift fractions. John Parati making his move on the far outside, and Scott Thurston goes with him. Jessica Alpert is gaining ground. Matthew Reed, where is Joe Sullivan? The favorite has yet to fire. We're coming down to the finish. It's Safran, Schwartz, Thurston, Alpert, Parati, and Reed. Joe Sullivan with the flying finish. It's a photo, you call it.